to have our next guest. She's got a great, really interesting new book out, which, you know, I've talked a lot about John Perkins on this program, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, the Corporatocracy. I think this is somewhat similar to that. She is a professor at the School of Public Policy, George Mason University, and also a senior research fellow at New America Foundation. Her latest book, the one I'm referring to, is titled Shadow Elite, How the World's New Power Brokers Undermine Democracy, Government, and the Free Market. She joins us now in studio, Professor Janine Weddell. Is that right, Weddell?
Yes.
Janine, let me get you a little closer to that microphone, by the way. Everything you're wearing matches, by the way. You are very well-dressed. I feel very...
Well, everything you're wearing matches,
everything
too.
Everything
I'm
wearing
black
is
and white.
Sponsored
Sounds
by
good.
The...
You could be a nun.
I actually interned as a nun for a little while, and then I found out I was a man. Can we talk in relation... We've been talking healthcare, and we'll continue after you leave, but can we talk about healthcare? Do you write a little bit about that in this book, which I haven't gotten to read all of, but I'm glued to. The book is Shadow Elite, How the World's New Power Brokers Undermine Democracy, Government, and the Free Market. Because I would... Let me give you one. I would think Tom Daschle might fall into some of this. Tom Daschle, the former Democratic majority leader of the Senate, got voted out a couple years ago. President Obama tapped him to be the Secretary of Health and Human Services. He had just written a book on how to reform health care. But he works for some industries that make a lot of money in the healthcare industry. So it's like he's influencing the conversation and profiting from it. Is that fair? And is he a good example of what we're talking about?
Yeah, well, what I'm charting is a new system of power and influence and a new set of power brokers. And the way that they do business is different from power brokers of the at least the immediate past. Tom Daschle is a great example. They move seamlessly among a bunch of different roles. Tom Daschle, as you said, former senator. He's been a policy advisor recently to Obama on health care and to Vice President Biden and to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid to strategize on health care reform. At the same time, he's also been a consultant to medical insurance and pharmaceutical companies. So the question for the public is, what is his agenda? Who does he actually represent? And how can we, the public, know who he represents? Because we're not privy to those closed door meetings in which he's clearly a player. And we can't really look to the legal system either, because he's not a registered lobbyist. He's one of these high flyers who moves seamlessly among a bunch of roles. And unlike registered professional lobbyists, these new power brokers have roles that are not fixed, and they're not terribly visible. So there's a real problem with accountability here. He and the players like him are not necessarily unethical. But the point is, there's an information
system,
but
the system,
we don't know.
The system that they're not doing anything necessarily illegal. I mean, we can argue whether they're unethical depending on your ethics, or you're immoral depending on your morals, but they're not necessarily doing something illegal. Let's stick to Democrats. Because you mentioned Larry Summers in your book. And I always like to bring up Larry Summers. I was in the tank for Obama, it's fair to say. In his transition period, he appointed Larry Summers, who's a fairly a controversial character. People learned quickly about who he was and what his roles in the past were. Basically, Larry Summers and Robert Rubin, former Treasury Secretaries for the Clinton administration, deregulated the banking industry while they were in government, then left government and took advantage of the rules they changed and profited by the hundreds or millions of dollars, it's fair to say. Larry Summers goes in the private sector. Certainly Robert Rubin is even more a better example. But Summers then comes back and works for the next Democratic president, President Obama. This is what we see. I mean, is this the shadow elite that you talk about?
Yeah, and here again, you see, there is an information problem for the public. I first began watching Larry Summers in the 1990s when he was helping to orchestrate Russian economic reform when he worked in Clinton's Treasury department. And he was very instrumental in not only the reform agenda in Russia, but in highly unusual foreign aid contracting arrangements at the time, which went to some of his close friends who were involved in Russian economic aid. And the way of operating was very much that official information was locked inside of private networks. These players, they create their overlapping agendas to serve their own overlapping roles, to serve their own agendas, and they rewrite the rules of they create their own rules of the game. They skirt official bureaucracy and government. And so I saw him and his team operating that way, in that way, in the 1990s. And then when he went to Harvard, of course, the Harvard's endowment made off with some, was involved in some investments in Russia, which were highly highly unusual, and then under Summers, they made some very risky investments, and Harvard's endowment lost more money than most investments, even to the extent that they were also investing some of the cash reserves, as I understand it. So when he was appointed, when he then came to the government, to the current administration, you know, one can only wonder what he's up to, because many of the same people that he's been working with all these years are back in the loop.
Let me ask you about the free market, undermining the free market. The book is Shadow Elite: How the World's New Power Brokers Undermine Democracy, Government, and the Free Market. My guest is Professor Janine Weddell, and you know, this sounds like almost like a liberal or progressive book, because you're saying, you know, we're talking about deregulating industries or something like that. But I would argue that the idea is to change the rules so that certain industries and certain groups and certain people can profit. And you know, for example, they always talk about our state to state, opening up in insurance competition of state to state. Well, why not open it up for other countries to compete too, if you're going to add that? Well, no, we don't want that. We don't want United Kingdom's insurance companies. That would be a free market. So it's not really a free market by definition. How are they undermining? How is the shadow elite, as you call them, undermining the free market? And why would conservatives be concerned about that?
Well, I mean, I think you're alluding to the fact that there is no such thing as a free market. Every context in the world has rules, informal or otherwise, that in which the market is operating. But the players that I'm charting break both the rules of the government, of the state — those would be the rules of accountability — and the rules of business and the rules of corporations. Those are the rules of competition.
But we don't. But free market conservatives don't — forgive me — like rules. They don't want, you know, it's that might be this. Not be a good representation, but you're saying rules of accountability.
But when it comes to the market, they break the rules of competition. You know, the key principle of business, which is competition.
How do they break that rule? How do they break the rule of competition?
They don't want competition. When you think about think about the increasing interdependency between the federal government — I'm just give one example, the U.S. federal government and business. Take, for example, the fact that 3/4 of people who work for the U.S. government, federal government today, are actually working for private entities. They're contractors. They work for companies for the most part. Companies are becoming more intertwined with government. Those companies are not out there as free market beacons competing.
Can you give me an example of a company that you're talking about? I'm thinking about Walmart. About Walmart comes in. There's no competition for Walmart. I guess Target. But there's little competition for banks. There's almost little competition for airlines. They all come together.
I mean, yes, it's all a monopoly. Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's plenty of evidence on growing amount of evidence on the record showing that what is being created are, you know, big monopolies, the too big to fail syndrome. So, I mean, that's a key part of the landscape on which the players that I'm charting are operating. And you see private, when it comes to government, you see the private sector overtaking government in a way, in the sense that the information, the legitimacy, the expertise, and so on, is moving to the private sector. And you see at the high levels the intertwining of state and private power. I mean, think about who's making the decisions, the economic decisions. It's a small interlocking group of Wall Street government players.
Yeah.
Right. And they're the ones who have the information. They guard it. They can brand it for everyone else. They can tell us what we think we want to hear.
And the thing about Wall Street is it's so hard to understand. It's like, you know, they're doing these unethical things and credit defaults, but they know that we can't understand it. It's not nearly as easy as to understand, I think, as healthcare, which itself is complex. But the Wall Street, the way money is changing hands, and the credit default swaps and the bundled mortgages and all of that stuff, which is continuing right now. Guys are making a lot of money today off of producing nothing or betting on things that don't exist or that things will fail. And it's hard for us to understand. It's hard to take a stance on that and argue it because you have no idea what the hell's going on.
That's
unless
right.
You're inside
mm-hmm.
and played lacrosse at Duke.
Right. So it's this. It's inside information. It's that these
that
players...
That wasn't fair to the Duke lacrosse team. I apologize. Sorry.
No, I mean, it's that these players have what should be official information. They're guarding it within their own little... click their own little circle, and then they're able to brand it for the rest of us to say, oh, this is really, you know, great, we're really making progress, the economy is getting better, you know, we're doing these things on Wall Street, etc.
Let me ask you about, because this piques my interest when I see this chapter titled U.S. Government Incorporated. I mean, people are using the word fascism to describe U.S. government because of its relationship with corporations. Who runs this country? Do corporations run this country, or does government run this country? Does the president and Congress and the Supreme Court? And after you answer that, when did that change? Was it the other way around? Did government used to have power over corporations?
Well, I think that what we're seeing today is an intertwining of state and private power. And the world has changed in this country quite substantially in the past several decades. We had the deregulation and the privatization that was captured most poignantly by the Ronald Reagan era of the early 80s. But a lot of changes took place during the Clinton era. In the 1990s, mm-hmm. the Clinton administration changed the contracting rules, for example. So now there's much less competition in effect between contractors and government authorities, and increasingly government services, government functions are contracted out. So that, as I said, today, three quarters of people working for federal government actually get their paychecks from private contractors. And these are government functions. Contractors are choosing other contractors. They're overseeing other contractors. They're doing policy work. They're doing much of the intelligence work. The United States has more contractors in Afghanistan and Iraq and in the Department of Homeland Security than it does government or military employees.
Well, that's what happens when you don't have a draft. You can only have just so many people volunteering for that job.
What about Homeland Security, which is supposed to be so important? The United States, we have more contractors in Homeland Security than
security contractors, for example, like what department or division?
No, I mean just contract employees. These are not private security contractors. I mean, these are people who are doing intelligence work. I mean, all manner. The Homeland Security was made up of what, 22 government agencies, from the Coast Guard to, intelligence, etc.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I wonder about also about the think tanks. Well, let me before I get to that. The let's just deconstruct how that works. I mean, I was just down in D.C. and I did this piece. I want to plug the new CNN show I'm doing, but about lobbyists for John King USA. And I said, you know, there's thousands of lobbyists any day, federal and state, and what they do is they meet with representatives, senators, and congressmen and women, and they say this is the legislation that we would like to see, and lobbyists are lawyers, so they can actually write legislation and they can hand it to me. I mean, how does it work, Janine? I mean, you talk about a corporation and their interest, an industry and their interest. That industry, let's talk about the private health insurance industry because of today. They hire lobbyists. Those lobbyists' job, and they're paid well, is to do what, and how does that work?
Well, I'm not an expert on lobbyists, but I mean, I think what you alluded to is correct, that they're very often helping to draft legislation, helping to make it easier for the people who are ostensibly writing it, the congressmen and the senators, their staff, that is. But what I think is actually more a problem in our age is, at least we know what the lobbyists are up to, or we think we know what they're up to.
We do.
But we don't know so much what the people who are beyond the lobbyists, like the Tom Daschles, who are playing these multiple roles. I mean, the lobbyists, at least, you know, they have to be registered. I mean, you're right. We don't exactly know what they're up to, but we have their roles are at least fixed, and we can play a better guessing game about them. But what about the high flyers? Whose roles are not really fully disclosed, and we don't really know who and what they're representing, right? That I think is a real problem of information and accountability.
Transparency?
For our age, exactly.
Is the Obama administration bringing transparency to any of that the way they promised, or is that just kind of,
I think it's, you know, we're dealing with a systemic change that, I mean, the system has changed dramatically and substantially in the past three decades. You don't just snap your fingers and change something back, right? I mean, we couldn't just all of a sudden go back to an age without the internet, right? And we're talking about changes that are the way things are done. The intertwining of state and private power, the fact that so much of government work is now done by combinations of people who are outside and inside government and so on. You don't just snap your fingers and change it back. It's much more complicated.
Well, I frankly liked the Dewey Decimal System and encyclopedias myself. I found it much easier to look through an encyclopedia than Google. Let me talk to you about think tanks, because this is, you know, this is another thing that we're really, I think we on our program, we've kind of been discussing this. We're kind of in the forefront of what are these think tanks, how much influence do they have? And again, how often do cabinet members, senators and congressmen and women move from government to a think tank? And is that bad? Because they're not really profiting there, are they? I mean, the incentive isn't quite the same to change legislation, then go to a think tank and make millions of dollars off of
it.
Right.
Well, first of all, full disclosure, in addition to my role as a professor at a university, I'm also a research fellow at the New America Foundation.
Yeah, and we get a lot of guests from everywhere.
In Washington. So, and I like having different vantage points from which to see what's going on in the world. There are data showing that the role the number and the role and also the role of think tanks is increasing, and that they've become more politicized and short term in their orientation, their focus in the past few years. And so I think that's important to take into account. It is also interesting, and to note that think tanks, some think tanks are being used to get policies out and distributed in the media.
And
that's a very interesting development. Yeah,
you're talking about, for example, if you ever read John Mearsheimer and Stephen Waltz, the Israel lobby, they talk about in there the idea that editorials were basically written to influence, you know, an op-ed is written by someone, but funded, you know, by AIPAC, or, you know, who's you know, that's timely as well, or the NRA, or let's talk about, you know, a clean energy, whatever. I mean, they fund, it's good, bad, whatever you think it is. They have people writing editorials in newspapers for the interest of their group, their think tank, right?
And it's absolutely not, I mean, money plays a role in a lot of these things, but oftentimes it's ideology. That a lot of these think tanks are quite, I mean, the word think tank is a misnomer, really, because they're less about thinking than they are about putting out their own versions of the world.
There's these great charts in your book. The book is Shadow Elite: How the World's New Power Brokers Undermine Democracy, Government, and the Free Market. And my guest, Professor Janine Waddell. I buy the book just for these charts, because what they do is they show in these charts, in the chapter titled The Commanders, where cabinet members, I think mainly here, or important peoples in, for example, the Bush administration, what think tank they went to. And the chart has arrows going from where, for example, Paul Wolfowitz leaves, obviously, the Bush administration and goes to PNAC, the Project for the New American Century, American Enterprise Institute, Washington Institute of Near Policy, U.S. Committee for Free Lebanon, Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs. And it draws a line from, you know, the Bush administration, the table they sat out, to the think tank or, you know, ideological group that they went to and worked for. And it is really, really interesting. And just telling, you're like, oh, all these people went from there to here. And I think, I don't know if I mentioned this off the air, you know, we could demonize the Obama administration. We've been taking a shot at Democrats. But with the Bush administration, a lot of their EPA people went to oil and gas industry companies and think tanks, right? And their interest, the people that worked in Bush's EPA left and went to ExxonMobil, et cetera, right?
Right. And so those interests are pretty clear. And one of the things that I'm talking about in this particular chapter, this is about the what I call the neocon core. It's a dozen or so people who are interlocking, have been working together in different venues and incarnations for about 30 years to remake American foreign policy in their own image. And most recently, they are among those who helped take the United States to war in Iraq. And this particular chart shows the variety, shows that this very actually small but influential group of people set up a number of different so-called think tanks in the 1990s. And they have a kind of family-like quality, because it's the same set of people who are setting up a number of different organizations. And this is really reminiscent to me, and this is also one of the themes in the book, it's reminiscent to me of transitional Eastern Europe, where you had power vacuums. The communist regimes fell, and there were power vacuums that had to be filled, and they were filled by these people who had been working together for many years, sort of under the table, who then, you know, occupied all the important roles in the state, in the private sector, in non-governmental organizations, and so on. So there's a real parallel here that's very interesting.
Let's just take we've only got a couple minutes with our guests, but let's just take a couple calls. Brett in Florida, you're on the air with Professor Janine Waddell and her new book, Shadow Elite. Go ahead, Brett.
Thank you, Professor Waddell, and it's very interesting. I'll look forward to reading the book. But one thing that drives me crazy is, especially in times like this when we have polarizing situations happening, like the healthcare bill, etc., people get labeled liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican. From what I'm hearing from you, it really sounds like both sides, which there shouldn't be a side, because to me they all kind of play the same game. Do you find that in your research they intermingle and play the game together so they can benefit themselves? I always have this idea that, you know, at the end of the day, on the weekends, both of these sides, regardless of what your perspective is, they play golf together at the same country club, and then they work on a new deal. That's my perspective.
Well, so, I guess it, yeah, I mean, you're right. I think it depends on who we're talking about. What I'm really charting is a new kind of power broker, a new way of that these top shadow elite, a new way that they are actually doing business. And that, because so much of government is outside of formal government today, and with the end of the Cold War, there are so many more unregulated arenas, be they financial or opportunities for cross-border, you know, mafia activity or whatever. There's so many more arenas that there are many more opportunities for private players to have influence. And what I'm charting is the way that they have influence where it used to be states and international organizations were in control.
Those influences kind of hedge their bets. So they go, like you talked about, family groups kind of going from one institution or organization to another. So they're kind of hedging their bets, whatever situation occurs.
They're very flexible. They're very flexible, and they perform these multiple roles. They can morph from one thing into another. Ambiguity characterizes them, and they're certainly not either. I mean, certain groups can be driven by ideology, but the mode of operating that I'm charting, they can be liberals, conservatives, Tea Partiers, coffee, whatever the term is, players.
Coffee Party USA.
Coffee Party.
Yeah. The Smoothie Party, which is congregating right now at a Smoothie King near you. Well, here's my question. I want to, Brett. Thank you. Always great to hear from Brett, smart dude. I wonder if you offer, do you offer solutions? I mean, because this is, I think what we need to do right now is have more books like this and more research like this about the relationships between government and corporations and, as you call them, the shadow elite, and uncover how government is working, et cetera. But what do we do? And was there a time, again, that we need to go back to where government had you know, the say? And I mean, was that a time?
One of the trends that I talk about is the lack of authority, the lack of loyalty to institutions, for better or for worse, whether it's government or corporations. I mean, look at Enron. I mean, the Enron dealers didn't have any loyalty to the shareholders. Their loyalty was to their cronies in Enron, right?
Well, so, neither did the people working at a lot of these investment banks, these mortgage
exactly.
brokers countrywide.
So, the loyalty to organizations, in this mm-hmm. case the corporations, doesn't exist in the way that it used to. We need to demand information, and we need to support organizations like, I'll just throw out a few, like Center for Public Integrity or like Project on Government or Oversight, POGO, that do real investigative journalism, mm-hmm. real investigative reporting. Beyond that, though, I think we have to look at our society and to look at our culture of what Stephen Colbert calls truthiness. Because when people can no longer be shamed, when it is that Larry Summer can morph from his not so positive role in Russian reform to his not so positive roles at Harvard to his not so positive roles with the US government, and all the while being promoted, or Robert Rubin can do the same thing. Where does shame come into it? What?
I'm sorry, shame?
Shame.
I'm
failure.
Sorry, what is that?
What does
I'm sorry,
failure?
I'm not familiar with
well, so there's
that word.
When people can't be shamed, when failure doesn't lead, when failure just
jail?
Promotes success.
Just
well,
jail.
That's great.
Is
but,
that shame? Is that failure? Is jail? Is a jail sentence too harsh for a lot of these people like you know, the Enrons and obviously Bernie Madoff? But I mean, there's a lot of guys, I think, on Wall Street that I don't know if they did anything illegal, but if they did, if we find that they did, jail, not a fine. If ExxonMobil dumps oil and knows they're doing something, jail. Again,
yes,
not fines,
yes.
But fines
yes.
and jail. All right, well, we've got to let you go, but let me ask you one final not serious question. The only reason you wrote this book, to get on the Colbert Report? Have you been invited? Because I might be able to facilitate
well,
that.
Well, I'm hoping to be on the Colbert Report.
If only we knew someone who worked there. Janine Waddell, thank you so much. Professor Janine Waddell, Shadow Elite is the book, and I look forward to having you back to talk about the issues that you talk about in this and hopefully some solutions as well. Really great to have you on. Thank you.
Thank you.